Well, thank you, Professor Jeffrey. May I thank you, Professor Carmichael, and Dr. Cormley Heenan for your invitation to join you this evening. Ta achas mór urim a bhéin seo live in you. I'd like particularly to welcome the international delegates to Belfast, and I think that it's particularly fitting that the PSA conference has been held here this year, a year in which we are showcasing our towns, cities and countryside and spreading the word that we have a truly wonderful place to visit. Indeed, a number of the world's leading travel guides, including National Geographic, have highlighted recently that Belfast is a must-see city in 2012. Of course, Derry City, or as some people call it, Londonderry, is a must-see city for 2013. So when you come here, don't just stop in Belfast. There's much to do and see in Ireland, north, south, east and west. I understand that some of you will have had the opportunity to take some tours around the city, including a visit to Stormont yesterday, and I hope that you enjoyed your time there. Tomorrow, some of you will visit the new Titanic Belfast, the world's largest and most interactive Titanic visitor attraction. I had the honour of officially opening it with Peter Robinson last weekend, and I would highly recommend it for a visit. For too many years, a Titanic story has been told the world over, but not in Belfast, the place of its birth. However, we can be proud of the story of the Titanic, and this new wonderful visitor attraction is there for all the world to see. I mention this because the recent history of the north of Ireland coming out of a troubled past, but now on a journey and moving forward together, can be illustrated through the symbol of the new Titanic building, which I believe is a jewel in the crown of Irish tourism. New and proud for the north of Ireland, and one with a bright and better future for us all, and all of us who live here and all who visit here. I hope you've enjoyed the conference so far, and that the discussion on various political themes over the coming days will be engaging. I understand that many of your conference sessions have focused on examining our politics and our peace process. It has looked at loyalism. It has explored aspects of republicanism. It has focused on the peace process. And it has also looked to the future. And it certainly looked to have been an interesting 3 days. So I hope that your visit to Belfast has afforded you the opportunity to go out into the city and experience the real and tangible benefits that have been reaped from the peace process. We have still much to do and must keep working to progress and develop a long-lasting peace that is embedded into every aspect of our society. And it certainly was a long and sometimes frustrating road to peace. It is a road that all of us involved on a journey that we could continue today. It's not a journey that has seen some change, but it has been a journey that has seen dramatic change. The fact that Peter Robinson and I at the last Assembly elections were effectively seen to be standing on the same side and were rewarded with increased mandates truly signals how far we have come. It was clear from that election that the vast majority of our community wanted us to continue to work together for the benefit of all of our people. And I regard it as a great honour that the electorate have bestowed their trust in us to continue the work of peace and political progress. For those of you that have watched our politics over the years, you will fully appreciate the shift that has taken place. We can never forget our past and our history, but I am interested in writing a new history for future generations, one that is inclusive and prosperous for all of our people. You will all know that the history of the conflict here has been widely researched, published and debated, and you will also know that the peace process has also been the subject of much academic attention. And as someone involved my whole adult life in this process, I'd like to spend a few minutes to talk about some of the key features in our political journey. For many, the conflict in Ireland, rooted in centuries of war and division and violence, had seemed intractable. Every generation had known conflict, and between the cycles of violence, there was a despair of oppression and discrimination, of instability and institutional violence. The cycle seemed destined to continue into a depressing future. That there would be no military solution was, I think, blatantly obvious. That reality has not sadly been learned by a tiny number of militarists who delude themselves in believing that the continuation of conflict will destabilize the peace process. The reality is that their actions make us stronger and more united. Our peace process has demonstrated that with imagination and dialogue and a commitment to achieve peace, it is possible to rewrite the script. Making peace can be hugely challenging and enormously difficult, and it demands that we seek to understand what motivates, what inspires, and what drives our opponent. Ultimately, as Nelson Mandela said, we have to make friends with our enemy. In constructing a conflict resolution process, Irish Republicans looked at international examples. We drew on their experiences, but we also used our own common sense and understanding of the situation in our country and of the relationship between Ireland and Britain. While clearly no two conflicts are exactly the same, the broad principles to address and resolve differences are very similar and can be adapted to suit specific needs. And these elements are that the process must tackle the many causes which lie at the heart of the conflict. There must be a good faith engagement by all sides. The process must be inclusive, with all parties treated as equals and mandates respected. All issues must be on the agenda, with nothing agreed until everything is agreed. There can be no vetoes. There can be no attempt to predetermine the outcome or preclude any outcome. And there should be a time frame. This is essential to provide a dynamic in the process. Participants must stay focused and be prepared to take risks and engage in initiatives to advance the process. And none of this was easy. Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress were very helpful to us. We travelled to South Africa, and they travelled to Ireland along with many international representatives who have enormously helped our process, not least from the United States. We have taken our experience in recent times and we've tried to be helpful in peace processes, for example, in the Basque Country. And I've been involved in efforts to make progress in the conflict in Sri Lanka and have met in Finland with different groups from Iraq and have visited Baghdad. So our journey is one that I wish to share with others. The starting point for any process must be dialogue. This is the foundation upon which any progress is built and was absolutely central to our process. Confidence-building measures are also crucial. In the north of Ireland, this meant, among other things, improving conditions for prisoners, including moving those who were in England closer to their homes in Ireland. It meant demilitarising the environment and ending the use of emergency laws and repression. And, of course, a new beginning to policing and the release of political prisoners. It also meant respecting and acknowledging the democratic rights of all political parties and treating them as equals. So our journey was sometimes incremental and frustratingly slow, but it was always forward. By the time of regular engagements with the British government and the Irish government, it was clear that the landscape had changed, particularly with the election of Tony Blair as Prime Minister. This led to an accelerated push for peace. The resulting Good Friday Agreement of the 10th of April 1998, reached after multi-party and government negotiations under the chairmanship of US Senator George Mitchell, was a culmination of dialogue that had begun many years earlier. It was really the first of its kind. Not only did it establish a power-sharing devolved assembly and executive, it had, crucially for Republicans and nationalists, formal cross-border links, and also it provided a comprehensive framework for relations between Ireland and Britain. It also paved the way for police reform and demilitarisation by the British government and recognised that the prisoner issue had to be addressed. The agreement provided a truly historic opportunity for a new beginning. And of course, 6 weeks later, on the 22nd of May 1998, the agreement was overwhelmingly endorsed by voters north and south. On the 25th of June 1998, the first elections to the new Assembly were held, with the voters returning 80 pro-agreement and 28 anti-agreement candidates. It must be remembered that the DUP, with whom we now share power, were opposed to the Good Friday Agreement. So it was clear while the agreement laid the foundations of the peace process, the process had a long way to go. But although we had an agreement which was endorsed by the people of Ireland, North and South, there was still much talking to do, and it was indeed not until the 1st of December 1999 that devolution was up and running. It lasted until the 11th of February 2000, when the British Secretary of State, Peter Mandelson, faced with a pre-written letter of resignation by First Minister David Trimble, suspended the executive. It was the first of a number of suspensions, the longest of which commenced on the 14th of October 2002. Although in suspension, assembly elections went ahead in 2003, and they returned the DUP and Sinn Féin as the largest parties, a trend confirmed by the Westminster and local government elections of 2005. I and my party were very clear that a strategy had to be developed which would enable the DUP to come into government. During the short period of devolution, as many people know, they never took their seats at the executive table. One of the most interesting encounters in the aftermath of the assembly election of 2003 was whenever Gerry Adams and I went to Downing Street to meet with Tony Blair and Jonathan Powell, his chief of staff. And I remember the meeting very, very well indeed. We were in a small sitting room in Downing Street, and Tony Blair was at the point of despair. His attitude was that the Ulster Unionist Party had to be got back into a superior position to the DUP at the upcoming Westminster elections, which by that stage was quite some time away. So he spoke about this for 6 or 7 minutes, and I stopped him after about 7 minutes, and I said, Tony, if that's what your strategy is going to be built upon, then it isn't going to happen, in my view. The DUP, in my view, are going to be the predominant party within unionism for between the next 10 and 15 years. And Tony said, well, Martin, difficulty with that is I don't believe that Ian Paisley will share power with you. And I said, well, I don't accept that analysis. I believe we can make it happen. So at that stage, we had to convince Tony Blair that his strategy of propping up David Trimble and the Ulster Unionist Party wouldn't work. And I think at that meeting, Tony finally got the message that the strategy had to be recognised and the job of work had to be done. I told him it wouldn't be easy, that it would take time, it could even take a couple of years. But then eventually, between the 11th and 13th of October 2006, multi-party talks were held in St Andrews in Scotland, and the St Andrews Agreement paved the way for a restoration of the institutions in 2007. That agreement reaffirmed the fundamental principles of the 1998 Good Friday Agreement, commitment to exclusively peaceful and democratic means, stable, inclusive partnership government, a balanced institutional accommodation of the key relationships, North and South and East West, and equality and human rights at the heart of the arrangements. Assembly elections were held on the 7th of March 2007, with both the DUP and Sinn Féin making gains, and later that month we met face-to-face for the first time. On the 8th of May 2007, devolution was finally restored, with Ian Paisley and I appointed to the post of First and Deputy First Minister, respectively. 4 days later, Sinn Féin agreed to take their places on the policing board, and with Sinn Féin and the DUP sharing power and Sinn Féin endorsing the current policing arrangements, we were all really in a new place, and in my view, a much better place. In December 2007, I was able to tell the world's media in Washington that up until the 26th of March that year, Ian Paisley and I never had a conversation about anything, not even about the weather. But after 7 months in office, we never had a bitter word, and we were both earnestly working to create a future in the north of Ireland where everyone would feel at home. And it made a big impression on me whenever Ian Paisley, in one of our early encounters, said, you know, Martin, we can rule ourselves. We don't need these direct rule ministers coming over from London telling us what to do. And for me, that was common ground that we both could stand on. There was still, of course, one outstanding piece in the jigsaw, the issue of devolution of justice and policing. The St Andrews Agreement had put in place a mechanism for exploring this, and this was finally achieved with the Hillsborough Castle Agreement of the 5th of February 2010. The Hillsborough Agreement and the Stormont Castle Agreement of the 24th of March 2007 between Sinn Féin and the DUP were step changes on the road to the political stability which our people presently enjoy. We've had our first full term of an inclusive assembly in the history of this state. I sometimes refer to this as the awkward term. And as I said at the beginning, Peter Robinson and I have come out of the most recent elections with increased mandates, and we've resolved a number of issues that were expected to hang over us in this term. Again, we have shown leadership and did what others said we would not do. So the next 4 years will see us deliver an agreed programme for government that has delivering for all our people at its core, with the economy and tackling disadvantage the top priorities. And all of this, it's important to remember, I'm still an Irish Republican and Peter Robinson is still a Unionist. But we, each Unionists and Republicans, now have a peaceful democratic process in which we can pursue our political goals while at the same time allowing all of us to tackle important issues like the economy, disadvantage, sectarianism, racism, and other issues that affect all of our people. Peter and I have over the last few years been successful in bringing more much-needed jobs from our investment visits to the US than at any other time in the history of this state. We're just back from another successful visit, and we'll go in the next few weeks to India, while China will be visited before the end of the year. And this demonstrates that we are working together for the benefit of all of our people. The day-to-day realities of politics and the economy are now part of our focus and must remain at the centre of our process. Unfortunately, the focus has not been evident from the coalition government in London, who have effectively reneged on an agreed peace dividend of approximately £4 billion, which was part of an £18 billion investment package agreed with the then Prime Minister Tony Blair and Chancellor Gordon Brown. Peter and I have lodged this in the formal dispute mechanism of the Joint Ministerial Committee, and my view is that the coalition government is not focused on the long-term stability of the peace process. So I want to conclude with a word or two about reconciliation and its role within our process. Proper reconciliation is the key to the future. Reconciliation is essential between our communities, Republicans and Unionists, and also between my community and the British state. It will not be easy, but it must happen. Republicans realise that dealing with the past will not be an easy process for us. Republicans inflicted much hurt during the conflict, and of course much hurt was also inflicted upon Republicans. But if we are to build a new future, it is necessary, and it is a road that I am not afraid to go down. And in my experience of recent years, many within the Unionist community are up for that journey of reconciliation and dialogue. For Republicans, increased dialogue and engagement with the wider Unionist and Protestant community is absolutely vital and essential. That means being prepared to set aside our own assumptions about the nature of that dialogue in order to better understand the fears and apprehensions of Protestants and Unionists. I believe we have to listen unconditionally to what they have to say. Republicanism needs to become more intuitive about Unionist apprehensions and objections and sensitised in our response. We need to be open to using new language and consider making new compromises. Our conflict is over. You've seen that whilst you've been in this city. The conflict is over, and the imperative of creating a better society at ease with itself is a new challenge for us all. Republicans will approach that laborious work with compassion and imagination. We will ensure our engagement is based upon listening carefully to Unionists and others, and we must develop the capacity to explore what more can be done to help meaningfully heal our society's divisions. Dialogue, using new language and making new compromises to create trust, are the seeds of a new nation for us all. Acknowledgement and reconciliation are critical to reconciling our past with our hopes for our future. An American President Abraham Lincoln, seeking to tackle the legacy of 5 years of bloody civil war in that country, sought to articulate a vision for his battered nation. It is no less appropriate for us in our time. With malice towards none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wound, and to do all we may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. As an Irish Republican and as a Democrat, I remain convinced of the right of all of our people, unionist, nationalist, or neither, to determine their own future, a peaceful and prosperous future for us all. Sometimes in politics, compromise is a negative word. Even in the past, people said it was a dirty word. But we should not be ashamed of the compromises that we have made here. I am proud of the compromises that I and my party have made to bring about a stable peace. We should all be proud of where we have taken our people. So our political message is a fundamentally hopeful and positive one, focused on our young people, on our future, and a better quality of life for everyone. So I want to thank all of you for coming, for making the effort, and for very seriously considering where we've come from and where we're going in the future, and how what we have learned during the course of our process can possibly be used for the benefit of others. One of the other key decisions that Peter Robinson and I took was how we would use the Mays Long Cache prison site. And we have decided that we're going to build on that site an iconic building for peacemaking and conflict resolution. It won't be a shrine to anything other than peace. And we have made an application to the European Union, which has been agreed. The money has been granted, something like £18 million. Other money will come from the Heritage Lottery Fund. And we will be very determined to ensure that this iconic building is constructed over the next number of years so that others from other conflict situations throughout the world can come and listen to our experiences and make their own judgments as to whether or not any of the lessons that we have learned applies to them. So I hope that when you leave here, you go out with a very positive message. The war is over in the north of Ireland. The conflict is over. Leadership delivered what we enjoy today. We are going to continue to give that leadership, and in the end analysis, we believe we are the people who will prevail. Gur mila mila mairgh.